Hello, I'm Penina from Circle Care Services, and welcome to My BCBA Life. Circle Care Services is an ABA therapy agency, and we're all about giving BCBAs the support and community you're looking for. With this podcast, you're not on your own anymore. You're part of a BCBA community committed to making this world a better place to BCBA. Once this episode is complete, you'll be able to obtain a free CEU certificate for the clinical topic discussed. You'll need to confirm your attendance by taking note of the three surprise words I will drop throughout this episode. There is a link in the show notes below of a form that will ask you for your information and the surprise words that we need to generate your CEU certificate. Thank you, and let's get started. Welcome, Matthew, to My BCBA Life. Super excited to have you here. If you could please share your amazing journey of you being a BCBA to our listeners, I would appreciate that.
Thank you for having me. My name is Matthew Lunsford. I'm, of course, a BCBA. I hold an MSW in clinical social work, master's of science in psychology, and an MAD in special ed. I'm also licensed as a teacher and a supervisor in clinical social work. My journey to become a BCBA was atypical. I did not know that ABA existed until I started my journey to becoming a special ed teacher. At that point, during my master's program, I pivoted to doing both at once, and here I am. I've been a BCBA since 2021, and I've been in private practice since then, so going on four years now.
Wow. So you are not just the BCBA. You have a lot of titles under your name. Going into each one, I'm curious how you think that helps you be a better BCBA by knowing more, just to take us a little bit towards that, because it's not common for BCBAs to be, BCBA is big enough. So what led you, what's your education story? How did you manage that? And what brought one to the other?
So my original, bump me back up for a moment. So I am legally blind, and my original plan was to become a clinical psychologist, which is why I ended up with a master's in psychology. But that did not pan out for a multitude of reasons. So at that point, I shifted towards becoming a special education teacher. Like I said, I ended up becoming a BCBA during that period as well. Then after that, I started practicing, and I felt that being just a BCBA was not enough. So I went back to work towards my clinical social work license. I'm now working towards my doctorate in clinical social work. But to address your question, not to diss on BCBAs, but I've noticed that many tend to be very myopic in how they approach things. So that just behaviorist lens. My case, drawing on psychology, I look at things from a neurobiological perspective. Well, it's what we in the social work field we call the person and environment perspective, which is very similar to how a behavior analyst looks at things. But we're also looking at behavior and the individual in terms of social systems. So as a example, if I had an individual who was engaging in stealing behavior, the behavioral conceptualization would be perhaps an access function. Whereas if we look at that from a social systems standpoint, we might say, okay, this individual was of a low socioeconomic status and doesn't have access to food or resources. So yes, it's an access function, but what can we also do to modify their environment to get them access to things like the EBT program or whatever other resources are out there, so they don't have to engage in theft anymore to meet their needs?
Very interesting. My first word is paper. Yeah, there's always a plus when you bring in another person's perspective. So with you, you have the few perspectives. You could look at it this way, you could look at it from the other way, and from another lens, which you keep building your knowledge upon. But I think, like you mentioned, for a BCBA, it's important that if they don't have all those different, you know, mindsets, to bring in people who do, kind of like a three-person team. Being an actual three-person team, you're kind of like a three-person team in one to a child, you know. Every child has a whole team of people behind them. So, you know, they have the BCBA who gives from the behavior analytic lens, and then you have a psychotherapist looking at it from their lens. But you have both on the child, which is very beneficial, and I guess less room for miscommunications.
Yes, it's nice to be able to speak multiple clinical languages and, yes, you know, be able to rephrase things for different professionals.
Absolutely. That's very cool. Okay, so now going into tapping into one of your amazing wealth of knowledge that a lot of BCBAs don't have, and which is really the anatomy of behavior, because a lot of us BCBAs, we talk about behavior from more of the science of behavior. We're looking at it through that kind of lens. But you found as a BCBA that that wasn't enough, and you felt like you were missing a big piece, which drove you, from my understanding, to learn the anatomy behind it. Walk us through that and give us more backgrounds in that sense.
So you can best think of the brain as the body's computer system, right? The brain is organized structurally from front to back, with the most complex functions being in the front of the brain, and then towards the middle and on back, we have the more we call it rudimentary or primitive functions, or otherwise known as lizard brain. So a lizard, when we say lizard brain, we're referring to those neurological functions that are needed for survival. So, for example, thirst, hunger, seeing, things of that nature. So the front of the brain we call the frontal lobe, and that contains what's called the prefrontal cortex. In the middle of the brain, we have the temporal and parietal lobes, which are responsible for movement and speech primarily. Within the middle of the brain, we have what's called the hypothalamus and the hippocampal formation. The hippocampal formation is primarily responsible for hunger, but it also contains the amygdala, which is the fear center or emotional center of the brain. And in the back, we have the occipital lobe, which, as the name suggests, is responsible for vision and processing visual stimuli taken in from the eyes and the retina.
Okay, that was like a good tour of the brain. It's amazing how much the brain does for us. And we're like, a lot of, I'm talking for myself, but like, I know the basics, but it's so amazing. And, you know, we just take it for granted without realizing how each piece, what it does. And it's just very amazing to hear. But I want to, even before we go further, I really want to take you a step back and, from the BCBA's perspective, why do you feel like all this, understanding the brain and how it works and how it plays into behavior, why do you feel it's so important for BCBAs to really know it, to practice?
Because what I've found working with other BCBAs, one of the biggest errors I've seen other BCBAs make is that they will frequently think that all behavior is related to the environment, when there's a very good chance a problem behavior might very well be related to a deficit in the brain. As an example, I have a patient with a TBI. He was unfortunately involved in an accident at some point in his earlier years, and that resulted in damage to the frontal lobe. So now he is fortunately highly impulsive and will say whatever comes to mind without any thought to the consequence, to a BCBA of the standard training. They might say, okay, this is an attention function because he's getting a reaction, you know, out of the from the people he's saying these things to. Whereas in reality, there's physiological damage to his brain that is the actual root cause.
Interesting. Just curious for that patient. I know we're veering off, maybe jumping ahead. What do you do then if it's the he's not capable? It's an issue with the brain. What do you do?
So there's something called neuroplasticity. Essentially, it's where the brain can repair itself. It's a very slow process, but I have him working on explicit instruction in social skills. So taking the functional piece out of it. So because we know it's neurological in nature. So what I have staff doing with him is sitting down with him and teaching him explicit social skills and also offering correction when he, almost like errorless learning. Whenever he says something, it's inappropriate. For his BIP, I have staff actually just take him aside and be like, hey, you know, I know you didn't intend to be rude, but what you said at the grocery store to the clerk may have been interpreted as rude. Instead of saying X, you might want to say, you could say Y instead. And over the past 3 years that we've been working together, he's showing tremendous improvement.
Wow.
Still has his off days, like anyone with a TBI, but he's making wonderful progress.
My second word is bag. That's amazing. And obviously, the only way he's able to make progress is because you are at the right root of the issue and you know how to deal with that, which is interesting because for sure, if you would tell me that per se without knowing, you know, I'm saying most people would know the history that he had a traumatic brain injury and then they could deal with it as such by asking the right people. But it's really important because if you would have focused just from the attention end or even whatever you would interpret it as based on the behaviors only and situation he's in, there's no way you'd be seeing the progress you'd be seeing now because he actually needs to be taught and his brain needs to be from the beginning, from like a little child getting them taught.
Yes, that's correct. Because if you just treated it as an with a DRA, with teaching alternative ways to receive attention, it's sure you'd probably make some progress with the appropriate reinforcement, but it wouldn't be what he actually needs to be able to recover as much as he can.
Right. Okay, so take us back. Sorry, that was just jumping ahead. I wanted to just give everyone like a very good idea of why it's a very important topic because I'm a big believer in it. And I happen to think anatomy just for everyday life is crucial, especially when you're dealing with children where it makes such a big impact with the story. So now that we have a good idea of the brain and how it looks, tell us more of how, what part of the brain is crucial in terms of behavior and why one brain might be activated over the other in different scenarios and how we can kind of recognize that and deal with that.
So there are three main structures that I feel are important for a BCBA to know. One, the prefrontal cortex. Two, the amygdala. And
can you spell that?
Three, quite right. AMYGDALA, I believe.
Okay, amygdala. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's Greek. It means almond because the amygdala is almond shape. And lastly, the final structure would be the nervous system as a whole. So I'll give a simplified explanation. So the nervous system consists of obviously the brain, but also the spinal cord. And within each vertebrae, which is a chunk or section of the spinal cord, you have a structure called the spinal canal. And what happens is the nerves come out of the back of the bottom of the skull in a structure called the foramen magnum. And they're fed through each of these little holes in the spine. And then the nerves are go off to wherever it is in the body. And that thereby it acts as almost like a highway, if you will, from the rest of the body to the brain. So looping back, the frontal cortex is important because this is the brain's attention and impulse center. So in, let's, as an example, in individuals with ADHD, there's less volume within the prefrontal cortex. So less volume means less neurological connections. Less neurological connections means less activity. Therefore, you get the impulsivity and the other symptoms associated with ADHD. If the amygdala, as I said previously, that is the brain's fear center. So when that is overactivated, that's when you get things like severe anxiety and panic attacks. So what does this all mean for autism? In the autistic brain, there's far more neurological connections than in a neurotypical brain. So what that means is that we have the hypersensitivity. So when there's essentially there's so many neurological connections that the brain is getting overwhelmed. And when that happens, knowing now that the spinal cord is part of the nervous system, when that brain gets overwhelmed to the amygdala, that's going to thereby affect the rest of the body.
Also, I think like another key point in this is when a child is in, their amygdala is activated, so they're in that fear mode, and something basic that you wouldn't, that wouldn't put me or you or anyone else in that fear mode, we don't realize, but you can't talk to someone. Like you said, like the prefrontal cortex is shut when the amygdala is activated. You can't be smart. You can't make smart decisions when you're just petrified. You're just, you know, when your body's in that mode. So it's very important to also recognize that a learning, attempt to teach is not when the amygdala is activated. It's when the prefrontal cortex is. Can you take us through that a little bit and why it's also important to know that?
Yeah, so one of the key components of anxiety is what's known as fight, flight, freeze. And one of the many behaviors we frequently come across as BCBAs is aggression. So that would be it, you know, that, the fight portion of fight, flight, freeze. So when the nervous system of an autistic person is in overdrive due to the overactivation of the amygdala or really any portion of the brain, they're going to be able to teach them anything. So because they're so overregulated, they're so, basically they're trying to, it's like self-preservation essentially. So when an autistic person gets aggressive, 99.9% of the time, that's because they are overwhelmed. So if we want to actually be able to teach them, say, life skills, for example, we need to also teach them self-regulation skills, whether that be through something like deep breathing, appropriate non-harmful stimming. All of that helps to regulate their nervous system and get them back to baseline so that they're ready to engage or do whatever they need to do or want to do without that aggression component.
Mm-hmm. Or any other component, how it manifests. Like, what other manifestations of behavior tells you that this child's not in learning mode, but their brain is overloaded, or any part of their brain, like you said, it doesn't matter which part of their brain, any point of overreaction is not a good thing.
So one of the signs that I look for is excessive stimming. Like I said previously, autism stimming is used for neurological self-regulation. So if you see an autistic child excessively rocking back and forth or whatever their stim is, that should be your cue. Hey, like, I'm overwhelmed right now. I'm trying to calm myself down. back down, you know, give me that space. And then, you know, we can go back to whatever the activity is, you know, once, you know, I'm in a better physiological state. Because if you try to work with someone who is, you know, overwhelmed or dysregulated, you're not going to make progress in teaching. And if anything, it'll be punishing for them, and you've lost whatever ground you've made whilst pairing.
100%. It's such a key point, and it's like really like, you know, a lot of BCBAs might have been able to say like, yeah, of course, like if I see a child acting very intensely, that tells me, of course, they need to deregulate. But understanding the science of it, it does add a whole nother like perspective where you understand where you're taking this child, like where in their brain you kind of are, and how to like deregulate them and make them calmer. And you see like their brain's like turning like colors in a way. If you really see it, like, okay, now it's red, don't do anything. Okay, I see it more in the prefrontal, calming down. It's getting green. I could start talking to them and bringing them back with me. What, take me more through what you feel is very important for other BCBAs to understand from the anatomy, now that we have like even a bigger picture, going a little deeper, if you may.
So I think the primary other use that a BCBA would have for this knowledge is, of course, knowing how to teach self-regulation skills. Because the nervous system is composed of you have two nervous systems. You have your central nervous system, which is responsible for voluntary activity. So like intentionally moving your fingers. Whereas it's called the parasympathetic nervous system, which is responsible for involuntary actions. So like things you don't have to think about. So breathing, your heart beating, digesting your food, things of that nature. But the parasympathetic nervous system is also responsible for bringing the body back to homeostasis, which is that baseline level. So going back to the amygdala, if that's overactivated, the central nervous system is going to be going into overdrive. So to essentially switch that off, for lack of a better phrasing, you want to activate the parasympathetic nervous system. And that will look different for every child, every individual. Being a yoga therapist, my go-to is always teaching deep breathing exercises. So that is probably my found to be the quickest and most effective means. But if there's like, let's say, a pulmonary issue where the child cannot do the deep breathing, let's say they're on oxygen or something of that nature, I would look at forms of meditation. So like I'll frequently use like a fidget to help with self-regulation. So if someone's very tactile, you can give them, let's say, a pebble or I have an individual who loves a squishy like Rubik's Cube. So when I see that she's getting overregulated, I say, okay, here's your Rubik's Cube. Do you need a minute? And more often than not, she can either like nod yes, or she'll sign, depending on where she is neurologically. So I'll give her space to fidget with her Rubik's Cube. Generally, after about 5 minutes, she's back to baseline, and we can dive back into whatever it is we were working on.
That's great. And I just want to like make sure everyone realize that you threw in like another certification, that you're a yoga licensed teacher. Please, can I ask if you could take us through an exercise of breathing? I would love that. What is like your favorite one that you find is most effective? My third surprise word is pearl.
So assuming there's no contraindications, what I always teach is called the 4-8-8 technique. So what this is you will inhale through the nose for 4 seconds. You're going to hold the breath for 8 seconds, then slowly exhale through the mouth for 8 seconds.
For 8 seconds, so 4 inhale. AP.
Mm-hmm. So normally I have people repeat that 3 times in a row for the best benefit. But essentially what you're doing is you're forcing the parasympathetic nervous system to activate because you're intentionally increasing oxygenation to the brain. And when that happens, it stimulates the PNS to activate and help calm the body down.
It was actually very relaxing. I have to say, I just did it. It felt very good. Teach me more. What else do you have up your sleeve for us?
there's also something called box breathing. However, I don't feel comfortable teaching that because that can induce hyperventilation if you aren't.
I think I've heard careful. Of it once. Is it where you look? Can you explain it? I won't do it.
Yeah. So the way I teach it is to try to imagine a box in front of you, and you breathe in time with the movement of your hand until you have formed a box, and you just repeat that until you feel calm or you're out of your anxiety or whatever amped up state you're in. There is also something called skull shining breath, and essentially that's intentional hyperventilation. And the purpose of that is to increase activity in the central nervous system. However, again, that can induce hyperventilation if you aren't very careful. So mm-hmm. I almost never teach that.
Why would a person want to increase their activity? Like, why would a person want to do that?
So within the yoga therapy field and Ayurveda, which is the Indian system of medicine, it's based on herbs, plants, yoga, and breath work. That would be a natural treatment for depression. So in depression, you frequently see underactivity throughout the brain. So by using skull shining breath, it's kind of like jumpstarting a car in a way. So you're giving the brain that boost of oxygen to really get stimulated. But I always recommend, if I'm going to do that, I always recommend other strategies such as doing walks in nature as a form of meditation. I prefer a holistic addressing things from multiple perspectives whenever possible.
Got it. Okay, thank you for that. That was very helpful. You know, we always talk about self-regulation, deep breathing. I never ask someone further, like, tell me deep breathing. But being that you're a yoga teacher, I felt the liberty to ask you, is there any other self-regulation skills that you have besides for deep breathing that you feel is also very important to know that could really get the brain back to homeostasis?
So I do this with my psychotherapy patients as well, but there is a form of active meditation called the 5-4-3-2-1 technique. And the reason I prefer to teach this is it's something you can do anywhere. It's what's called a grounding exercise, and apologies for getting mentalistic on a BCBA podcast, but the intent is essentially is to help you stay in touch with your environment. So what you do is you find 5 things in the environment that you can see that are, to use ABA terminology, reinforcing. Once you've found those, you move on to 4 things that you can hear, 3 things that you can touch, 2 things that you can smell, and 1 thing that you can taste. And obviously it gets increasingly difficult as you go. But the point is to get you to fully focus in on your environment. So whatever it is that's upsetting you or causing a dysregulation becomes an afterthought because you're so hyper-fixated on the environment that you're in.
It's very cool. It's very cool. So really, like, wow, what you took us, this journey of, like, really giving, like, a whole new perspective to BCBA, which is unique. Most BCBAs don't have that background knowledge, I know. From my experience of talking to BCBAs. So thank you for that. And just to, like, wrap this up, and, you know, there was so much information, so I feel like I just want to give, like, interrupt me if you may at any point, but just understanding the very basic of the structure of the brain will help you understand where your client is. And it just brings another way you could look at the behavior and say, is this a factor in why they're acting this way? And maybe we could address it through this and not. It's just another way of collecting ABC data, another perspective we're putting in there, and knowing that if there is something that you think might make sense, something in the brain is affecting their behavior, to really talk to someone, an expert in this field, if you're not, which is very possible, to get their take on it and what recommendations they have to work on the brain to help the behavior be more positive. And then because the brain really affects the behavior, to understand it's at that point where the brain is hyperactive, that's when the self-regulation skills are needed. So for all the BCBAs we all are very much always talk about when the child needs those, like, self-regulation skills before, it's very often where a child with autism is overreacting. So with all that, knowing that it's because of the brain and we need to bring their brain to homeostasis, we're working with their brain by either doing breathing exercises or mindfulness, any other thing that works for your client, the fidget toy that talks to them, and really bringing them back with us so that we can continue either working on whatever you're working on or just bringing them back to a state of feeling good and homeostasis. So that was, like, all, like, I think in a nutshell, so much perspective and wealth of knowledge that you threw in there. Is there anything you want all the listeners to walk away with that you feel is important?
I think you covered the bulk of it, but I would also add, if you do suspect that something neurological is going on, always make sure you refer out to medical to pinpoint exactly what you're dealing with. And if you feel it's within your wheelhouse, fantastic. If not, seek out supervision from someone with more knowledge. If it's something you want to pursue or gain more knowledge in, I recommend looking into getting certified in traumatic brain injury. Yeah, BCBAs are qualified to go through TBI certification training, and it covers all the brain anatomy in depth, as well as some strategies to how to work with specific brain injuries within each region of the brain.
That's amazing. I think I even know a few BCBAs who are going to jump on that. So thank you so much, Matthew. I so appreciate it. And it's been a pleasure having you on the show.
Thank you so much. A pleasure being here.
Thank you.